Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that puts the contest into Lib Dem leadership contest. My name's Corey Hazelhurst and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hello.
Now, silly season is nearly over, and how best to finish our mini silly season than by talking about the Lib Dems? We didn't talk about them much in our election postmortems, and we haven't really talked about them much for a while, so we're going to have a quick chat about what their future prospects are. The June election a really good result or a bad result for the Lib Dems?
Six of one, half a dozen of the other. In terms of overall seats going up, you know, that is a good result for them. Especially when you look at the a number of the MPs who have either regained their seats or are now new into Parliament. Mm. They are of a very high calibre and high quality, and the sorts of people who will be either are already being talked up as future leaders in the form of Joe Swinson, or potentially, you know, leaders at some point in the form of Leila Moran in Oxford West and Abingdon, provided she can maintain that seat and hold on to it. So in terms of, you know, seats, yes, it was absolutely a success. And at the end of the day, British politics is all about how many seats you win. The problem is, they also managed to do something which I thought was completely impossible, which is fall back even further on the overall vote share. They won more seats because their vote was more efficiently utilised, but to fall back even further from 2015 is in some ways quite impressive, and it just demonstrates that, you know, the Liberal Democrats still have an awful lot of work to do if they want to even get back to double digit polling.
They got 12 seats, probably more than the Lib Dems have had for most of the past 80 years, if we're being honest. Nearly one in five. I think there's seats like five, isn't there, where they're only, I think, four votes away from winning.
I believe it was two.
Was it two? As you say, losing votes on 2015 is shameful, yeah. Really, from what we thought was a historic low base. Of the 57 seats that the Lib Dems held in 2010, they were third in 15 of those seats. They were fourth in a further six of them. So it feels like what's happening is the Lib Dems are becoming less and less of a national party. It feels like in June, loads of people just assumed they were a wasted vote and it was this return to two-party politics.
Mm. Yeah, and to a certain extent, I think this is an issue that the Lib Dems have always struggled with, is when you look at seats where, you know, the Lib Dems win and then for whatever reason the candidate stands down, you know, they almost always then go on to lose that seat. Because so much of their appeal is based around that local MP, which then obviously presents issues across the board in terms of, you know, how do you actually grow your overall base when people stand down like John Pugh did in 2017 and suddenly they go from first to third in a seat where they're strong, they are active, and suddenly, well, it was all about John Pugh. And that I think, is kind of their root problem, is they've never actually had much of a core vote nationally. I think there's always been a bit of an illusion of one. I think it's always been bolstered up by events. So a classic example of this would be the anti-war movement voting Lib Dem after Iraq. That is no longer relevant. Therefore, people aren't doing it anymore.
Can we tell that to the Labour Party, please?
We can, but they won't listen.
Okay.
So all in all, the Lib Dems are just going to struggle until they can find a way to actually build that core vote. And it's something, there is some internal discussions around some figures, I believe it's like David Rendell and Mark Pack, who are both pretty big names within the Liberal Democrat Party, have produced a discussion, a leaflet of sorts, I suppose, on what that core vote should look like. But it doesn't seem to have worked so far, or at the very least, the Tim Farron's leadership doesn't appear to have found a way to tap into it in the way that that was actually going to deliver a meaningful change to their vote share.
Yeah, I suppose maybe before we talk about who they might appeal to, we should perhaps address the question of the happy pixie, Tim Farron himself.
Yes.
Because how much of the Lib Dems' lack of appeal, the fact they didn't grow the vote, how much of it is it down to Tim Farron, or how much of it is because of the fact that the anti-Brexit message they had was just, it's not the right time yet. I've argued in a post on the site that Labour should be a bit more anti-Brexit because you want to get on the right side of history. You want to be ahead of the curve and lead public opinion. So maybe it'll pay off the Lib Dems in the long run. It wasn't the right time. So how much of it is that, and how much of it is the Tim Farron and the whole gay sex thing?
I think Tim Farron definitely damaged the Lib Dems' chances and certainly cost them seats. I mean, you alluded to the fact there were like five other seats where they're in like second position. To be quite honest, I strongly suspect that given the closeness of the results, that if there hadn't been the Lib Dems' only real media story being Tim Farron has a problem with gay people in some form, Fife would have flipped. Other seats like Fife would have also flipped, which had very narrow margins. I believe some basic kind of number crunching has been done on this. It was something like an extra 1,000 votes would have won like three or four more seats. It is completely foreseeable that a campaign which didn't focus so much on the beliefs on gay sex of Tim Farron would have gotten those extra couple of thousand votes and given them more votes overall. The issue of Brexit didn't turn out to be the vote winner they wanted. I suspect it's one of those things where Jeremy Corbyn shot the fox for them, and it meant that there was no opening for them to appeal to the disaffected over Brexit.
What you mean, because of the positioning of the manifesto?
I think one, the positioning of the manifesto, and two, also because Corbyn has a policy platform which is very appealing to the people who are also most likely to be anti-Brexit. They were willing to potentially overlook that and vote for him regardless. Throw in that and the fact that really, people haven't forgotten tuition fees. People haven't forgotten the coalition. And there's an awful lot of people who are not quite prepared to say this is acceptable yet. You know, rightly or wrongly, whatever your opinion of that is, that's how people feel. And until the Lib Dems are able to put just some clear blue water between themselves and those and that period in government, as is the case with pretty much any political party that ends up in government, they are going to struggle.
Also, can we just have a quick... What the hell was Tim Farron meaning when he wrote in The Eye a few weeks ago that people are fine with religion if you wear funky garb or have nice colourful festivals, but the moment you show any sign of actually believing in this creed or thinking this stuff about Jesus might be true or that the faith might in any way impact on your conscience or your life choices, well, we don't like that one bit.
I have no idea.
It reeks. Funky garb and nice colourful festivals.
Yeah, I'm astounded by his argument and two, the use of his language there, because that sounds vaguely and almost bordering on intolerant of like other religions and kind of insulting anything that isn't Christianity. He's just being a bunch of silly foreigners dancing around in, you know, brightly coloured clothing.
It's not as if other religions have festivals of light.
I don't know what... Well, actually, I suspect I do know what he's thinking. He's probably now viewing himself as a bit of a martyr to his cause of Christianity. He probably genuinely does feel that it's unfairly been used against him. And to be fair, there's a certain element of that which rings true. The essence of liberalism is about, you know, not letting your beliefs govern other people's actions. And Tim Farron's voting record on LGBTQ issues is very, very good. Yeah, there's a couple of black marks, some of which are easily explainable, others are not. But all in all, compare him to Theresa May's record, and it's a really obvious choice who's more LGBT friendly. So maybe he does have a point that it was being unfairly used against him. But at the same time, he just handled it very, very badly, and which I think is what gave it so much leg.
Yeah, quite. I think I've spoken to a few of my friends who are religious, and they feel that Tim Farron got a bit of a raw deal, and they can completely see where he's coming from in the fact that there's a difference between not liking something and yet wanting to ban it. And it's like a kind of love the sin or hate the sin. But again, it's an argument he could have made. Basically, if he thinks he's a martyr, I mean, it's not as if St. Augustine was made a saint because he didn't prep an interview question. Like, that's all it needed was just a a 30-second soundbite, a minute soundbite, just saying what you've said.
Which, and I think I've said this on the podcast before, which would have also given him an opportunity to actually reach out to a certain segment of the Conservative Party who, you know, are quite religious. Mm-hmm. Your Tim Montgomery's of the Tory Party, who would look very favourably upon a Liberal leader actually attacking the media for focusing so much on religion. Use that as a soapbox to say, one, no, I don't have a problem with it, which he apparently doesn't. Also, he said, therefore, just come out and say that I don't have a problem with it, but by the way, this is completely unacceptable. Faith shouldn't matter, yada, 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 all of that kind of stuff, which would have won in some major props from a certain wing of the Tory party, who are the sorts of people that they needed to win over in a number of their, kind of, the south-western seats, which they were trying to take back.
Mm. Right, that's enough on the Happy Pixie. Let's go on to the next cab off the block, Vince Cable. Who I'm guessing is not to be confused with the Vince Cable, who in 2007 said he wasn't going to stand for Lib Dem leader because he was too old.
Yeah, no, so clearly a completely different Vince Cable, because this Vince Cable started parroting on about the cult of youth before he'd even won the leadership election, such as it was.
And he's not the other Vince Cable that privatised Royal Mail as well, is he?
No, again, that's a completely different Vince Cable.
Is Vince Cable just a traveller through time?
Is Vince Cable about to be replaced by Jodie Whittaker?
to be fair,
probably wouldn't hurt the Lib Dems' polling ratings.
No. One can be glib about 2007, and if you've listened to us in any way, shape or form, listeners, you'll know
we're glib.
Glib is kind of our default setting. But I suppose the leadership election of 2007 was a very different point.
Yes.
Because Min Campbell was 408 years old and looking it.
Yeah.
In 2007, every party was looking for their Tony Blair clone.
Yeah.
And the Lib Dems went, oh, look, Nick Clegg, you are our Tony Blair clone. Although there's the interesting parallel universe in which... Because Nick Clegg only beat Chris Hume by 500 votes.
And there was an entire bag of votes which came in late, which if they turned up on time, would have meant that Chris Hume won.
Mm. And if Chris Hume was deputy leader, while all the perjury stuff was going on, that's an interesting what if, parking that. So, it's a very different time. Is Vince Cable the man of the moment?
No.
Why?
I've never necessarily been that impressed with Vince Cable as a politician. A lot of his reputation is based around, he called the economic crash right. Well, yes, he did, but then again, he's called it multiple times.
Is this the Vince Cable's predicted 9 of the last 1 recessions?
Exactly. Mm. That is a well-known phrase, actually, within political circles, because there's an element of truth to it. I mean, Vince is a very bright and capable politician, but I just struggle to see how, even if he had a completely clean slate, how he would be able to reinvigorate the Liberal Democrats as a campaigning and a political force. That's made even more difficult by the fact that he is so attached to the coalition, by the fact that it wasn't just he was a Liberal Democrat and, you know, the Lib Dems treble tuition fees. It's the fact that he's the guy who masterminded that policy. It's his policy.
We're using masterminded in the loosest possible sense.
Yeah. But you know what I mean?
I know, it's, sorry, I know what you mean.
He was in charge. He was the business secretary whilst that was happening, and he was responsible for it. It was his policy. In a lot of ways, the tuition fee debacle was slightly overblown in terms of its impact on polling and things like that. Most of the drop off in the Dem support occurred basically the minute they went into coalition with the Tories. But it's symbolic of everything that went wrong with the coalition. And Vince, as the architect of that policy, becomes symbolic as the problems with that coalition, which reminds everybody of why they don't like the Lib Dems anymore.
Well, quite. I mean, Vince Cable spent most of the years in the coalition looking like a man who had left his wife for her sister and was constantly having to justify it in public. So while you got the impression he was... Because he was a member of the SDP, I think, wasn't he?
Yes.
You got the impression he was never really down with the austerity line that Clegg and Danny Alexander pushed quite harshly. He was still a major figure in government while that was going on. It's impossible for him to distance himself. probably why I lost a seat in Twickenham 2 years ago.
And this is before you even start actually looking into Vince Cable further back. Vince Cable, former head economist for Shell. That's going to be a position where there will be some kind of skeleton somewhere which people, regardless of whether it's necessarily overly true, people can beat him with.
Ironically, because crustaceans live in shells, they don't really have skeletons.
And the other thing is Vince has done a very sterling job during the coalition years of presenting himself as being on the left wing of the Liberal Democrats, as you just kind of said there. Oh yeah, it's the Social Democrat rather than that kind of Orange Book free market wing. Vince Cable wrote a chapter of the Orange Book. Vince Cable is the man who said we should scrap the Department for Business.
Are there four Vince Cables?
There's more, so many Vince Cables, and that's kind of Vince Cable's problem, is that Vince Cable will, in a way it's sort of similar to Tim Farron, will present whichever face of Vince Cable he deems to be most appropriate. Two-faced isn't the right word.
No, we've already established there's four of them.
Yeah, exactly.
Four-faced?
There's so many different versions of Vince Cable that it makes it very difficult to latch onto one as a kind of a dominant narrative, which in some ways in politics can be very beneficial. But when you're already marred and you've got a very long political history like Vince Cable does, it also means there's a hell of a lot of things you can be attacked on. And I think that's really where the issue comes. It's going to be very easy for people to just dismiss Vince Cable because of that political history and the things he's done. There'll be something in it for everyone to hate.
Yeah. Again, there's an interesting... We seem to say this every podcast, but it's true. There's an interesting Stephen Bush article in The New Statesman. And they talk about... it sounds like there's a lot of foreboding about Vince's leadership.
Yeah.
For a similar reason, they were foreboding about Tim Farron's leadership, because no one really questioned him on the whole Christianity, gay sex thing. I mean, but, you know, that worked out so well in the election, I'm sure this one will be absolutely fine.
I think the thing with the Liberal Democrat membership is that they are aware that Vince is a standby. An interim leader. Ideally doing a limited job of, you know, trying to fix the infrastructure, campaigning infrastructure. You know, ideally going in with a number of goals which should be completed within 2 or 3 years, at which point he stands aside and Joe Swinson can swan in and try and, you know, resuscitate the party on a national scale.
I suppose that's the thing, isn't it? It almost feels like the Lib Dems have had their next two leadership elections in one.
Effectively. What I've seen said about Vince Cable and Joe Swinson so far is Joe Swinson is now the deputy leader of the Liberal Democrat Parliamentary Party, which isn't the same as being the deputy leader of the party, but in essence it is. The phrase double act has been used to describe them. Not necessarily a joint leadership, but a leadership where Joe Swinson is going to be very heavily involved. There were some discussions and some rumours that maybe some deal had been done where Vince had basically said, you don't stand and I'll make sure I stand aside for you when the time's actually good.
Well, that's never gone wrong before.
No, never. Not once.
He'll be there in 11 years' time and Joe Swinson will be throwing typewriters at him.
I think the issue that the Lib Dems have is that there's just no one other than Vince, really, that could be credible, other than potentially Joe Swinson, who doesn't want it at the moment, and who can blame her? Coming into this situation right now is not actually going to be the best use of her abilities and the charisma and the kind of work that she could do. I mean, you alluded to earlier the notion that what if Chris Huhne had won that leadership election and you'd still had that coalition government and then the perjury charges hit and then everything. Well, Nick Clegg then probably becomes Lib Dem leader. All of the stuff that the Lib Dems have been hit by are therefore associated with Huhne and not Clegg, and suddenly Clegg can kind of come in almost as that white knight and able to potentially change things around. Maybe Clegg removes the Lib Dems from the coalition. There's all kinds of things that he could have done. Joe Swinson's looked at what happened to Clegg and kind of went, if your time is potentially a bit too soon, and you may not actually be able to make the most of it. You know, she's really young. Well, I think my favourite fact about Joe Swinson is the fact that when she was first elected as an MP, her young person's rail card ran out.
Makes me sick.
Yeah.
Look at us stuck in this bunker recording this podcast. But, what are we doing with our lives?
Yeah, so she's got plenty of time ahead of her. She's the darling of the Liberal Democrats, and she has been for quite some time. Of all of the people that lost their seats during the wipeout of 2015, Jo Swinson's probably hurt the most for most party members, because they had already starting to view her as, you know, that next generation. Especially in light of a number of the issues that the party had had over things like Chris Rennard and various...
I'd forgotten about him.
Yeah. Everybody wishes they could.
Let's finish off then and think about how the Lib Dems, whether it's under one of the four Vince Cables or one of the only Jo Swinsons, can rejuvenate themselves. So the elephant in the room, as you've alluded to, is tuition fees.
Yep.
It's the fact that Nick Clegg, before it was cool, took a complete mallet to what you could say was the Lib Dems' core vote, which was young voters. And since then has essentially dynamited any credibility they had with that particular part of their core vote, which then leaves the problem of who actually are the core voters for Lib Dems.
That's essentially the problem, is they don't really have any other than people who would vaguely identify in some way as Liberals. Mm. But not just identify as Liberals, because both you and I would identify as Liberals, but people who are hardline Liberals in multiple ways, because you've got to be a pretty hardline Liberal to basically look at both all of the other parties and go, no, these are all too authoritarian for me.
Mm.
Which is an awful lot of what leads to a number of people joining the Liberal Democrats, and it's certainly one of the most stringent criticisms that is thrown out late at the Labour Party by Lib Dems, is the authoritarianism that they exhibit at times, which is, you know, an absolutely true trend that exists.
It's fair cop. I mean, I think both of us, I mean, I've campaigned for Lib Dems, you've been a PPC for them, for goodness sake. Like, they have beliefs in electoral reform, in localism, in liberalism, which we both share those values. We're trying to promote them on the podcast. It's working really well so far. The impression I get is it's not just Liberals, it's pro-European Liberals as well. And interestingly, I was just going through Lib Dem Voice just to try and do a bit of background reading for the episode. I'm guessing that one should not take the comment section of Lib Dem Voice as representative of the party, just as the comment section of Labour List is not representative.
Or Tory Home. Yeah. Basically, just don't read the comments. Doesn't matter what it is, just don't read the comments.
Too late, because I did. It was interesting that you had a lot of posts on Lib Dem Voice which were I liked Margaret Thatcher, or I was a Tory and now I find them really silly on Brexit, and so I've joined the Lib Dems. And you had a few commenters then who were unhappy at what they saw as the rightward drift.
Yeah, I mean, there is certainly an element of within the Lib Dems that is that kind of left wing, not wanting anything to do with anything that could even be considered centrist, never mind, you know, right wing.
That's strange. You don't find that in the Labour Party.
Not at all, never. No, and again, I think this is one of the problems that the Lib Dems do have, is that at the end of the day, if you're a liberal party, there are multiple strings of liberalism. To a certain extent, it's easy to see how you can make, you know, Nick Clegg and Orange and the Orange Book Liberals with like Danny Alexander, David Laws, cohabit with the more left-wing members. But it's very difficult for you to see how people who are even more right-wing than Clegg and Alexander, who probably are smack bang in the middle of the left-right spectrum, they are proper centrists, you know. But there are liberals, George Osborne springs to mind, David Cameron also probably an example of this, Ken Clark maybe, within the Conservative Party, who are on economics are much more right-wing, much more right-wing on a number of areas, but their attitude on most things is very liberal. And you need those people in your Liberal Party to actually stand a chance at getting anywhere. But the Liberal Democrats currently are either unable or unwilling to make the case to those people.
It feels like the problem that the Lib Dems have is the same, basically existential dilemma they had 10 years ago, which is that they are a coalition made up of two parties, of the old-style Liberals and the SDP. And those two parties essentially fight two very different types of elections. You've got the ones where they're fighting in Lib Lab marginals in the north, and then you've got the ones in the south where they're fighting Lib-Tory marginals, places like Yeovil and in the southwest and so on. You need completely different sets of policies and ideologies to fight those two different types of races. The way that Paddy Ashdown and Charles Kennedy tried to solve that was essentially by abandoning equidistance and being in the middle of Tories and Labour, and they made themselves a pro-Labour anti-Tory party so that they would benefit from anti-Tory tactical voting, which worked really well. It grew the Lib Dems to 40, then 50 MPs.
Right up until the point you had to go into coalition with the Tories.
Well, quite. And then Clegg tried to bring back equidistance, which doesn't work. Then it just became they were the party in the middle of the road that was run over.
Yeah, and I think part of this boils down to the fact that the Liberal Democrats, the policies that they're really passionate about in a number of ways are either unpopular, electoral reform, or, you know, very, very popular, but they're not necessarily that interesting from a kind of a political standpoint. Mental health being a policy being a classic example of this. Mental health, massively important. Norman Lamb, brilliant campaigner on this issue, did some really good things as a minister in the coalition government on this. Sadly, a number of things have been rolled back by the Conservatives. But you will find Liberal Democrats talking an awful lot about mental health. And rightly so, I say. Very important issue. But it doesn't necessarily make you stand out. It doesn't necessarily, you know, deliver a reason to vote for them. Okay, the Liberal Democrats say we need to spend more on mental health. I agree 100% with that. But the Liberal Democrats can't win in my seat. So why would I vote Lib Dem? Mm. And I say this as a former Lib Dem parliamentary candidate. Well, why should people have voted for me when I'm saying, oh yeah, this is really important, when there's no chance of me winning? There's no or very little kind of headline-grabbing policy. And I think this kind of partially stands from the fact that policy in the Liberal Democrats is made by the members, you know, and it's a wonderful thing that it is done like that, and it can result in some very good policies which have been implemented. The personal tax allowance increase, which the Liberal Democrats brought in under the coalition, started life as a members' motion for conference. But it's a double members deciding policy and coming and writing policy can be a bit of a double-edged sword, in that it means the members are also setting that agenda, and you end up with an awful lot of things which are really important but don't necessarily stand out in the crowd, or the ones that do stand out, you end up with policies which are slightly odd in various ways, like banning goldfish from being given out as prizes at fairs and things like that. You know, from an animal welfare perspective, it's a very, you know, I don't think it's necessarily a bad policy. Problem is, it's never going to animate people to actually do things.
You can't imagine it being on a New Labour style pledge, can you?
Yeah.
Like five pledges.
And again, whilst the Lib Dems do definitely have radical policies, land value tax is a policy that I believe is on the books for the Lib Dems. Cannabis, legalisation of that. They have these policies, but half the time they can't use them because they're, as you say, fighting two different battles. And that land value tax might very well resonate quite nicely up in Sheffield Hallam, but it's going to screw you down in Yeovil.
In our last podcast, we talked about a curious phenomenon known as Mogmentum, and probably there we talked about the fact there's a lot of young Tories who are quite socially liberal. I mean, do you almost think there's a case for the Lib Dems to try and reach out to them, basically become a libertarian party?
No, I don't think they can make that switch. I don't think they can become a libertarian party, because if they do that, then they lose half of their current voter base. Okay, yes, they pick up that socially liberal libertarian wing of the Tories, but again, that's not the vast bulk of the population. And this is essentially the issue that the Lib Dems have. There are no easy ways out of this hole that they've managed to dig themselves.
Now, are they essentially screwed then? Is it going to end up being like it was in the 50s and 60s, where they will win 6 to 10 votes where they're strong, depending on the local MPs, but it's really hard to break out of the two-party system?
I think so, yeah. I think that for the time being, they are screwed. I don't think Vince Cable will be able to get them out of that. I think Vince Cable has the possibility of putting the groundwork in so that a future leader can get them out of that. But I don't think by the next election we're going to see any radical changes. Maybe their vote share will go up a little bit more. Maybe they'll hit double digits in terms of the vote share. Maybe they'll increase their number of seats. They win again, which, you know, is good, solid progress. But they're not going to get anywhere near that 50 kind of seat figure that they had last time.
It, to be honest, it's another separate podcast to talk about how the hell Brexit negotiations will play out by 2022. But I think if there is an election in 2022 and the whole thing is a stop Brexit election, a lot of those people who are quite pro-European will still have a same dilemma. Well, do we waste our vote for the Dems, or do you give a vote to the Labour Party, which is probably more likely to stop it than the Tories?
Yeah. Again, maybe the Lib Dems would have been able to do better if the Labour Party was led by someone other than Corbyn. If it was Yvette Cooper or Liz Kendall or whatever, much as I rate them as politicians and would genuinely prefer to see them as Prime Minister than Jeremy Corbyn. The issue basically comes down to that if they go in and start talking about Brexit and things like that, it opens up an opportunity that the Lib Dems could exploit. Corbyn can get away with that for some reason. People are prepared to overlook his sins on that one particular issue because of his views on other issues.
Does Tim Farron think they're sins?
Probably.
And we've managed to bring our conversation on the Lib Dems back to Jeremy Corbyn, which I think is
pretty impressive, actually.
It's typical of this podcast. We will be back after the silly season is finished, and we'll be starting our new series, actually, next week, From the Cradle to the Grave. We'll talk about it more next week, but it will be very exciting. In the meantime, do read A Very British Coup by Chris Mullin. We'll be talking about it in one of our future episodes. Also, like our Facebook page, facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. Follow me on Twitter at paperbackwriter.
And you can follow me on Twitter at centreradical.
And we'll be with you next week. Happy plotting.